They call them the Cocaine Cowboys. Yesterday, they struck busy Dadeland shopping malls, executing two Latin males in the Crown Liquor Store.
There was an exchange of fire between the two groups.
Smashed glass and liquor bottles flying.
The shooting continued outside.
Two men cut down in the hail of gunfire.
Victims of Miami's drug war.
The war got away, they had a machine gun.
They've got to find some way to stop this.
What are they going to do about it? What can they do about it?
And South Floridians wondered where the Cocaine Cowboys will strike next.
My name is John Roberts. I was born in New York, and I got involved with a group of Italians from New York. They were actually part of a mafia family. We opened about four or five nightclubs that became very big, and we were doing really well. One day, they just came in, the police. We had no idea why they were there, and then they told us that our partner, they had found him out on the Long Island Expressway, and he had been killed, and he had like 11 bullet holes in him. So who knows what happened.
The best thing that I could think at that time was, just let me get away from all this heat. So I moved down here and started into the cocaine business.
The city of Miami area was very, very quiet, and it was just a very pleasant place to live.
Prior to 1956, the night shift for the sheriff's department and one police car to patrol an area the size of Rhode Island.
Miami back then was the South. It was like Alabama. There was no money here. There were no big buildings. Downtown was pretty barren. Miami Beach, it was a lot of old people just sitting around in rocking chairs on South Beach waiting to die. And it was a whole different world out here back then.
This is why Miami is for you.
In the 60s and 70s, Miami flourished primarily as a vacation spot.
Al Sunshine, Al Sunshine, Al Sunshine, Channel 4 News.
Sun and fun on the beach, the palm trees.
Miami is a major transportation center and is easily reached by all forms of travel.
In the late 1970s, thousands of illegal and legal South American immigrants started entering Miami.
The Latin American influence has given Miami a unique flavor.
Miami had by then been established as an environment where a Spanish speaker only could thrive. Miami has always been sort of a piratey kind of fiercely independent environment where law and order was never championed.
Like a virgin city.
South Florida boy, and
one of the few that's that old is born here. I was in the import business.
Hi.
do your archaeology, you dig down, you'll find the gun runners, and then you'll find the rum runners, and you'll find the marijuana, and you'll find the Cuban immigrants, and you'll find the cocaine. This city has always had something coming in.
South Florida is the nearest U.S. mainland destination for South American drug smugglers.
It was wide open back then.
It was wide open.
There is mile after mile of unguarded shoreline where a boat can drop drugs undetected.
In the 70s, when I first came down here, everybody in Florida was smuggling pot in.
The Drug Enforcement Agency believes 95% of all marijuana smuggled into the United States comes through South Florida.
A friend of mine passed away. In his warehouse, he had 2,000 pounds of marijuana. What I did is I went in and took it. I didn't really know anybody in the business. I gave half of it to somebody, and I gave the other half to somebody, and I split it with them. If you were making $10,000 a year, you were doing pretty good. If you were making $20,000, you were doing phenomenal. I think I had like $165,000. So you're talking about 8 years salary. Ba-boom. And I said, this is pretty nice. There's got to be something more to this. It was too easy. And you could drive in with a boat, stacked up, pull up to the dock and unload it. Nobody said a thing. There was no defense of the border to speak of.
And at the present rate, according to some economists, the state's major industry could soon be drug smuggling.
You could be out in a boat and find bales of marijuana floating. I mean, the proverbial square grouper.
The Colombians realized they had a gold mine here, and when they were sending like all this pot, they would send a few kilos of coke. In the beginning, it was very small.
Because it was so expensive.
And they would bring them in a suitcase.
So you didn't see much of it.
And it would get extremely high prices for it.
Mid-70s with DEA, the priority was extremely low. Our office was pretty much shut down when it came to cocaine.
But it's not a serious problem nationwide, given the very large number of people who use cocaine. It is a serious problem for a certain small minority.
I met a Cuban man out in Hialeah, and his name was Albert San Pedro. Most Cubans got whatever they got from Colombians, obviously, because the Colombians, you know, controlled everything.
In drug trafficking, Cuban-American organizations here are often aligned with Colombian groups. Colombians importing the drugs, Cubans distributing them.
And Albert would front me a quarter of a pound, and he would give me like 3 or 4 days, and then I would go and bring him the money back, and then he'd give me another quarter of a pound. And I think I used to pay him somewhere around about 800 an ounce or something back in the 70s for it. And it wasn't of any quality, but a lot of people didn't know the difference, and they would see these big rocks and they would think, wow, this is great shit. And my clients weren't these people that you would think they would be, like these street people.
If anybody had cocaine, they had to be an airline pilot.
Real estate people down here.
Doctor or attorneys.
I had lawyers, I had doctors.
Somebody that could afford what it cost.
They were called weekend warriors. During the week, they wouldn't do anything, but on the weekend, they'd just go from Friday night till Sunday and do this stuff. And each guy would introduce me to another friend. So eventually, it went from 4 ounces to 8 ounces to 12 to 16, where within like a month, I was selling probably 2-3 kilos a week just to these doctors and friends. When I came from New York, I came down here with $650 in my pocket. And I was making $20,000-$30,000 a week back then just off of this little trade. I had a friend who I knew from New York. He developed a big, big trade out in California in the San Francisco Bay Area. He was selling to the Oakland Raiders. He was selling to the Grateful Dead. I had met a stewardess, and this stewardess worked for National Airlines at the time. So we would send coke with the stewardess, and she would go from here to San Francisco, and we were sending him anywhere from 5 to 10 kilos a week. And I was getting back big money at the time. I mean, you're starting to get into the 200,000-300,000. And back then, I started meeting guys, Mercury Morris, who was a great running back for the Dolphins, who also went to jail, so it's no secret.
Merck is just one fallen angel of the Miami football machine. Former Dolphins Don Reese and Randy Crowder were also arrested by Miami police in another cocaine transaction.
I remember the week of the Super Bowl when Dallas played Pittsburgh here. 2 nights before, I got the whole front line of the Pittsburgh Steelers in my house, and they all sat down. Come on, come on, break the shit out, break the shit out.
We don't get a chance to get involved in all the festivities and all the fun and the parties because we have curfews.
They partied, and they really partied harder. I mean, you have no idea what these guys would go through. I'm saying, you guys are going to play football Sunday? Yeah, we're going to win.
This one is over. Steelers repeat.
They went out and won, you know what I mean? It didn't affect them.
Well, our offensive line did a great job.
The popularity, it began to shoot up. Everybody that before was doing these pot things was now into doing cocaine.
We stayed in the pot business until it got to the point where there was so much pot here that you couldn't sell it.
And you just couldn't get enough cocaine.
I said, the best way to do it looks to me like if you got into the transportation end. You're not buying it, you're not selling it, you're not using it, you're just an importer. The Colombians threw a number at us that was more than agreeable. $3,000 a piece, or a kilo in your terms, and they wanted to move at least 400. We went down there on the first trip, we got paid $1.2 million. That was enough to excite us to say, maybe we'll stay in this trade for a while.
The people that I was dealing with had a limited supply. And as the people I was selling to expanded their business, I couldn't get enough. You know, one guy would say, I want 15 kilos or 20 kilos or 25 kilos. I could only give him 15 or 10. Then it was money coming out of my pocket. I can sell 100 kilos a week easily. I got lucky, I think, in about 1979. I met this girl.
I flew to Miami, and I was working on a shoot with a girl, and she told me that she had somebody for me to meet.
A friend of mine fixed me up with her. He was a lawyer. He was dating this really beautiful girl who was a model for Ford.
After I'd known John 3 months, it was my birthday, and I went into the garage, and he had a brand new Porsche, Target Carrera Porsche, and it had a huge bow sitting on top, a huge red bow for me. Yeah. But it was kind of a whirlwind thing with John and I. I mean, we felt very much in love. We were... The story I got was that he had discotheques in Manhattan.
As I started dating her, obviously she saw I wasn't working. Whenever I wanted to go to New York, I was in New York, and she got curious. I'm the type of person, I'm pretty upfront. And so I told her, hey, this is what I do. You don't want to see me anymore? Fine. She said, no, I have a friend, and he's a pilot, and he works for these Colombians. So the guy introduces himself. His name is Mickey Monday, and he's like a redneck from Florida that's been here his whole life.
I want to say I didn't like him. The first time I meet Johnny, he's driving this black Mercedes two-door that's got drug dealer written all over it.
Mickey Mundy had a very successful transportation for these people from Medellin.
Flamboyant. He just looked like somebody that I don't want to have anything to do with.
I mean, remember the show MacGyver? That's this guy. He could do stuff that just was incredible.
A sharp guy, but I just didn't like his vehicle. To me, it looked like all the other guys who were in the drug business.
I told him I outgrew the Cubans, and it became a necessity to find a Colombian that could supply the large amounts that were needed at the time. And he said, well, I'm going to hook you up. I can take you to these Colombians that I know, and this guy can give you whatever you want. And I'd heard stories like that many times, so I just said, sure, whenever you're ready, let me know. And we drove to Sunny Isles, Florida. And we go into this house. It was about 5 or 6 Colombians there, all like loaded to bear. When I say loaded, they were strapped. They had pistols, machine guns, and they were all standing around. And at that point, I realized this, you know, this guy's serious. This is for real, because people just don't stand around like that. I meet this little guy. He can't be more than 5'4", 5'5", and he introduces himself, and he says, my name is Rafa, and he's telling me, you know, I'll give you whatever you want, man, and if you got some money, I'll front you twice the amount of money that you come with. And I said, well, you know, show me something. He takes me in this back room, he pushes a button, and a whole wall opens up like this, and I had never seen so much cocaine in my entire life just sitting behind this wall. I said, okay, I guess you can help me, man. I said, give me a day and I'll put together the money and, you know, I'll be back. The next day I came, he had an American guy there, and he introduced this American. And he said, this is my compadre. You know, I'm not in town a lot, but whatever it is you need, this is the man. He'll take care of you, and don't worry about it. He's 100%. And the man he introduced me to happened to be this man, Max Mermelstein.
John introduced me to Max.
Max was, at the time, I thought a good person, and I thought, you know, a trusted person.
Max seemed like a very nice guy back then. Seemed that way, anyway.
In the beginning, Max was giving me like 75, 100 kilos a week. Eventually, when Max saw I was serious and this was happening every week, when you bring somebody $1 million every week, all of a sudden, you know, you grow, a bond becomes between people. And Max said, I want you to do my end of the business, going to Colombia, arranging the trips, and you split it with me, you're going to make much more, and you can continue to supply whoever you want. And Max sent me to Colombia.
This is the Envigado section of Medellin. It is here that the cocaine bosses meet.
And I would hook up with Rafa, and Rafa would introduce me to the people he was working with.
We met, you might say, the elite of the drug business from Colombia.
And it would be the Ochoas.
This was Pablo Escobar.
People that you read about in books.
Carlos Slater.
You know, here I was, a kid from New York, never thinking that this would really happen.
They make it sound like they had, you know, an office the size of this with computers, and they got 40 secretaries. It's just a bunch of bums down there. They were a bunch of street thugs. We got lucky.
Let's break it down a different way that people in America could understand. People in America are used to Italians and the mafia. The Colombians have their own thing. It's a mafia, only it's a Colombian mafia. There was only one family at that time that I knew, and that family was from Medellin.
The Ochoa family was a highly respected family of ranchers with a great deal of influence in their home city of Medellin, Colombia.
So they have, of course, the captain and the head, the capo, which was, as many people want to believe that Pablo Escobar was the king of cocaine and everything, they can believe that. But the man that was really the king was Ochoa. And not Favito, the poor man, it was the old man. The old man was the silent man who never did a day in jail, who really controlled Escobar.
Fabio Ochoa, the patriarch of the Ochoa family of the Medellin cartel.
They are credited with having created a Lloyd's of London for the cocaine trade in Colombia.
Rafa was like a lieutenant, and Rafa really controlled almost every kilo of coke that came into this country to the people from Medellin. Rafa knew it was coming, and Rafa knew who was getting it and how much they were getting for each one. And he made these people, millions isn't enough, because millions isn't what he made these people. There was nobody higher than him for the Medellin cartel in this country. And he had many soldiers, just like the mafia people have soldiers that would work for him. Some of them would sell the drugs, some of them were enforcers. He had accountants, lawyers.
So in your view, these fellas are not the cocaine cowboys?
Absolutely not.
You know, he had everything in this country, and they were a well-formed group.
Guess what? They're not all different people sending this stuff in. It's one organization, the Medellin cartel.
The feds charge the cartel controls 80% of the cocaine coming into the United States.
Federal authorities say these three men now run an organization more violent and at least as powerful as the American mafia.
From my experience in New York with mafia people and from my experience with the Colombians, they made far more money, the Colombians, in a far shorter time than the mafia ever dreamed of making, ever. The Colombians have farms, fincas they call them there, just filled with cocaine down there because they just kept producing it. They had guys chewing leaves all night, working in factories and chewing the leaves. And these guys, you know, they work nonstop. And down there's no industry. These guys were making their living doing this. These poor farmers and poor workers, they were getting paid a lot of money to do this stuff. And it was a whole process. It was like a factory working. And we worked with shortwave radios at the time. There was no telephone communication like people you see on the phones in the movies, you know. Hey, what's going on down there in Colombia? I need 600 kilos. It wasn't like that. We had antennas that would come up out of the ground, go 80 feet into the air for communication. We would have a certain time they'd turn their shortwave on, we'd turn ours, and we would talk that way.
But also at this hour in Miami, on a shortwave radio band that most radios cannot pick up, the coded instructions are coming in from a transmitter in Medellin, Colombia, for members of the world's largest cocaine smuggling organization. The cattle is ready. The cattle is ready. At 8 o'clock, 8 for the first one.
And that's how we would set up the trips. And we were contracted, actually, by the Colombians. I would make arrangements with them, and they would tell me, okay, there's 1,000 kilos. come pick it up.
Over the mountains, down, fly through a valley so nobody would see you.
And you never had a problem landing, you never had a problem taking off. It was all paid down there, the government worked with them, and we would send the plane down there.
The Colombians really didn't have, I'll say it, they didn't have their shit together. 99% of the strips we went to were dirt, grass. The people that worked there, that's the reason why we would take our own equipment. And you would see when you get there, wrecked airplanes. It's not gonna happen.
The plane would land, they would spend the night.
I mean, you'd land there and they'd say, oh, you want to stay? You want a woman? You want my little sister? You know, yeah, right. Want something to drink? I'm going, yeah, I really want to drink and get back in this plane and fly for another 12 hours drunk, right. The woman didn't sound bad.
The next day, they would be loaded.
There's two ways to come back from down there if you're flying. You can come around the east side of Cuba, which is the shorter, or you can come around the west side. If you had a lot of fuel, the west side was actually better because almost everything that was happening came from the Bahamas. So if they were patrolling, that would be where they would be. You're going to go where most of the action is. So you would come from the west. Nobody would think of you there.
Apparently, heavy surveillance and stricter enforcement on Florida's east coast is driving smugglers to the desolate west coast to make their connections.
We would pop the coast, maybe over by Marco Island, fly almost all the way to Georgia, and turn around and fly back. Now you look like somebody coming south. Nobody coming from the north south is doing anything illegal.
You could move 62,000 dead bodies in a plane in the United States because I don't know how many planes there are in the air at one time, but there's no checking. You land at a small airport and they don't have police at every airport. Hey, what's in your plane?
We would make it look like we were going into one of the local airports. What we'd do is just make a flyby. And head west, we bought some property in Lakeland. We built two runways there, put up a couple barns that were really hangars. They looked like barns. But when you'd open up the hayloft door, you would see that it was shaped to the tail of an airplane going. I would use a 5, 6, 8-year-old family car.
And we would load 300 pieces, and we would put air shocks on a car so that the car wouldn't fall to the ground.
And we would use a tow truck to tow the vehicle back.
We had a towing company that we formed, and we bought a gas station, a garage down here in Miami.
And the guy in the tow truck would have a work order.
We had a driver who obviously knew what was going on, but was told. You get pulled over, and they open the trunk of the car. You know, you don't know.
If you're driving the vehicle, it's kind of hard not to know what's in the trunk. Well, the guy in the tow truck don't know.
You don't know. You're contracted to tow the car, man.
He hooked up, and away he went.
Let him take the car and let him take you down there, but they can't hold you. You got the bill here and everything. And we would get a caravan with 2-3 cars going. We would use one car in front as a spotter and one car behind. They would bring him into Miami. And we did that for 6-7 years. Never had one little problem at all.
That was one of the advantages of Lakeland. I mean, there was always people being stopped going from Miami north, but you never heard of anybody ever being stopped coming south.
Nicky and them started to do airdrops.
They built me a small boat factory to play with, and we decided to do Columbia up to the Bahamas, airdrop it to boats.
And they had beacons that they would drop, and they would be able to know exactly where the load was because there would be a frequency that would send back to where it was. The middle console would open up. They put holes in the middle of the boat, and you would fill them up.
And then bring it in with boats. The big problem at first was the packaging of the product, which was a fiasco because the Colombians, being such wonderful people and organization, screwed it up for 2 trips.
It would get seepage. There would be salt water that would get into it, and it really kills coke. Salt water is really an enemy of coke. Mickey was determined that he could stop the leakage and told him how to wrap it.
I sent tape recorder, I sent pictures of it, step by step as to how to do this.
You have to understand, you're not going to tell a Colombian how to do anything. So Mickey could talk from today till tomorrow, and the Colombians aren't going to do what he tells them to do anyway.
Well, my guys go down, pick up the stuff, they come back on the trip, and it's not packaged. It's just like it always is. They threw it out the door. More than half of it busted up, and they lost millions of dollars because they didn't package it right.
So by their stupidity, it would get water damage.
They were all bent out of shape at me.
But they couldn't blame me. That's their problem.
Hey, it's your problem. It wasn't until the third trip that it worked. And then it worked and worked and worked. Sometimes I would run what we call the front door. The front door would be the entrance at Hollover. we would call it a front door. I can't say, well, you're coming in Holover. You're coming in the front door. It's a code of sorts. At Holover Inlet, I rented an apartment on the 12th floor in the northeast corner called the Harbor House, which has a spectacular view of the inlet. And I put a young lady there. I paid her to live there, paid for the apartment. And whenever we did a trip, she has an unbelievable set of binoculars. Of course, she has a radio. We found every radio frequency we could have against what we'll call the competition, the U.S. Customs, the local Marine Patrol. We would know if they were there, you're listening. So came home one time, I'm in a boat. Sometimes I was the guys working in the front door in the apartment. This particular time, I'm in a boat. I'm talking to my friends in the apartment. Lo and behold, here comes this U.S. Customs and U.S. Coast Guard. The guy's got an M16 rifle. We didn't think they were after us, but they were checking boats. Now, I'm in a boat that's loaded. But when he pulls up alongside of me, the motor on his boat's going bang, 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 bang. I said, geez, that sounds terrible. He said, oh, it's been doing this since yesterday. Oh, oh God. And he turns around, and he don't get 100 feet from me in his cup. Boom! I thought he shot the rifle or something. And he caught the wave just perfect. The piston comes out through the side of the motor and skips on the wave. It looked like some kid throwing a rock. And a big flame out the side just lights everything up. I go, God damn. And they're on the radio. Well, they can't get anybody. Said, well, this is superior equipment. Now I'm worried about these guys. I said, you guys need a tow. And I threw them a line, and they got on my boat, and I towed the U.S. Coast Guard and the U.S. Customs. But we're in a boat that had 354 kilos in it. The young lady that was up in the apartment said only I would. Anybody else would have panicked and probably jumped overboard. From there, we would go on up to the entrance to Mall Lake Marina. I had several slips that I rented. And the next day, my tow truck would show up with a work order and a trailer. My shop was only like 4 blocks away. The boat would go in there, and then we would go in the back, open up the compartment, and load the stuff into the cars.
All the merchandise would be handed to me. I had different stash houses in Miami. I used normal people. Working people that wanted extra money. I would try to find someone in a decent neighborhood that really didn't use the drug, because I made a few mistakes where I would go and I would find, like, you know, holes in the different kilos where people would pop a straw in, I guess, and then there were holes like a rat got into it. And it wasn't in one, it would be in 5 different ones, so that maybe there was a gram or 2 missing from each one. I would pull into the garage with these cars. I would take the product out. Every house had to have a garage, obviously, because there was so many kilos going in and out of the house, you couldn't just start unloading it in the street. I would count it, make sure that everything was there. It was all during the day. I never worked at night. Each product was marked with a marking. Maybe 300 would have bicycles and 200 would have eyeglasses. And each one went to a certain group. It was four different groups. And I had guys driving the cars to, say, a Denny's or Uncle Tom's Ribs. And whoever drove the car there would go inside, and there'd be a Colombian inside, and he would just hand him the keys. It was always delivered to Colombians, because they had brought their own Colombians over here to sell it. And that was it. There was never this Miami Vice ridiculousness in the street where cars would pull up with guns and everything. Let me see what you got in the trunk. I'm going to check it out and do tests and bring it back. It doesn't work like that. These people were controlled by the people down there. So it wasn't like they had a choice. They were taking it anyway. Whether it was garbage or it was good, they were taking it. The people that I gave it to were wholesalers. Those wholesalers would break it down into 25, 50, 75, whatever their different retailers desired. Now, I remember kilos going for $40,000, $50,000 in the street back then. And they would pay us for transportation of the kilos. Back then, I think that we were getting $3,500 a kilo. And what I would do to make sure we got our money was we would only deliver half. They would put the money in the trunk, and then they would return the car. I would then give them the rest of the product. So what we tried to do was keep everybody away from everybody, and that way there was no way to trace it back. That was my biggest fear, that these wholesalers who were giving it to 4 and 5 different retailers, one of their guys would get busted, and he didn't want to go to jail, so he would flip, and he might tell them, you know, this is my main guy over here, follow him, and you're going to follow him back to me. I'd hear stories from Rafa, like, I gotta go kill this guy because this guy got busted and he's gonna rat on my guy. And, you know, I hear all these weird stories. So what I tried to do was make myself never meet anybody because they were getting a car. They didn't know where the car came from because, you know, here's a car. And you never brought the car back to where you had the coke because you never wanted to have money and drugs in the same place. And the money would stay there in one of the stash houses. Out of that money, I would take my money and put the rest away because I would have to send back Ochoa's and Escobar their money. At that time, we were working with Noriega in Panama.
General Noriega's country is a mecca for drug money laundering.
So the money would be put on one of our planes, and we would fly the plane from here to Noriega's people.
He allowed them to use the airport for landing.
Because we would never send a plane with less than $10 million.
Unlimited amounts of money may be brought into and out of the country with no reporting requirements, and money laundering is not a crime.
The money would be taken off there by the Army, and the Army would take it to a bank, and we were partners in the bank with Noriega. And they set up accounts, and you had an account, and you just, whatever you wanted, you wrote a check for it. A lot of times, I would make a deal where instead of paying me the cash, out of this 500 kilos, give me 100 for myself, and I could sell them for 25,000. So as the loads would come, I'd be going through them, pulling out the best ones because they weren't all the same. And I'd be throwing them over here and throwing them over here. And it ended up where Max and I were making, like, every trip, $750, $1 million. And Max was saying, wow, I used to just make, you know, $250 from just the transportation. So not only did he plug himself in where he could sit home on his fat ass, he plugged himself into, like, three times the amount of money every week.
And the drugs were everywhere.
Everybody started using cocaine. I mean, I remember in the 80s, it was like,
I mean, cocaine was the end thing back then. It was a she thing to do. You know, you go somewhere and,
I mean, you couldn't go anywhere without going to a bathroom. And
I mean, you go in the bathroom, there was always somebody in there doing the line.
You hear a door slam, one of those toilet doors, and behind the door, you know, everybody's putting shit up their nose.
You would see guys coming out of the girls' bathroom.
There were clubs where the tables were actually mirror tops. I recall waiters helping patrons chop up cocaine.
It was a time in Miami when there were car accidents. These would just be routine accidents. Sometimes there'd be three or four or five of them in the vehicle. They'd jump out and run in all different directions, and you'd find cocaine guns in the cars.
They pulled this one over, and they found 30 duffel bags filled with 2,100 plus pounds of 90 to 95% pure cocaine.
But while busts and seizures of most drugs are up, there is more cocaine in South Florida than ever before.
We went from having cases of kilo or 2 kilos of cocaine to 1,000 kilos, which is a ton of cocaine, to 5,000 kilos, which is 10 tons of cocaine. There was a period of time where, over a 5-year period, I tried the largest amount of cocaine in history case 10 times. Every case was bigger than the last one and a new record.
Usually when prices of goods fall, this comes as good news. An exception are the current bargain rates for cocaine.
There were millions of dollars of drugs dropping out of the air. There was one day that the preacher was giving a sermon in a South Dade church, and one of the things he was speaking out against was drugs. And $500,000 in cocaine came crashing through the roof because the plane that was dropping it got off course and was being chased by a customs plane.
Price for the illegal white powder in South Florida has fallen by 50% in the last 2 years.
Oh my God, you got these people from Cali, you got another cartel from Barranquilla. You started to multiply all the cocaine that was coming into this country.
The Miami-Colombian connection is 80% of a $20 billion annual cocaine business.
Miami is one of the principal branch offices of what can be called Cocaine Inc. Florida is awash in cocaine.
It was everywhere.
It was everywhere.
It was everywhere.
Clubs, restaurants, it was just everywhere.
The elitist drug is turning blue collar.
Regular middle class folks think of it as beer or popcorn.
1 out of 10 American workers on the job is stoned.
People would wear it on their neck. Nobody hit it. Nobody tried to hide it.
And I tried it. Of course I tried it. But I could never figure out what people, why did they like it?
It is so intense. I can't even describe it. It's the best. It really is.
People went crazy for it.
In Dade County alone, fatal drug overdoses have increased more than 88% in just the last 12 months.
15 years ago, one coke-related death a year was rare.
Cocaine deaths in Dade County have now jumped to about
two a week.
People started smoking it.
Studies indicate that most cocaine users here have switched to smoking the drug.
Did you come here to smoke cocaine?
Yeah.
And not the crack, but freebasing, because freebasing came before crack. It became a rage. People are locked themselves in houses and freebase.
And I'd stayed up for almost 4.5 days straight, nonstop, no food, no sleep.
I couldn't understand, but I kept do it, you know what I mean? For me, it was just a business. So the more they did, the more money I was making. I came down here with $750 or $800. That's what I had to my name. I was 26 years old. I remember when I first started in the business, I used my grandfather's apartment on South Beach. I used to have kilos in his apartment, and I'll never forget the first time he looked at it and he said, "What is this?" And I told him what it was, and he said, "Well, I can't understand." I said, "Well, can you understand, I'm making like 50 grand a week." I remember one time I went to him, I said, "You know something, I'm not going to use your house anymore. I'm going to pay somebody." He said, "What do you mean? Well, don't do that. And I said, "It's okay, I got $1 million now." And he said, "You don't have $1 million. I said, "I got $1 million now. I'm going to pay somebody to put stuff in their house. I don't need to do this to you anymore." Because at that time, $1 million to me was a lot of money. It was the first million you ever make. So it's a lot of money. But after that, it was like it.
In the mid to late 70s, much of the American economy was in a state of shambles.
The financial pages of the Miami Herald were talking about a nationwide recession that was in progress.
Unemployment was huge. People were losing their homes. The real estate market went to hell.
The drug trade is rapidly affecting our economy here in South Florida.
But in Miami, you couldn't buy a house. In Miami, they couldn't get enough gold Rolexes to supply the local market.
For the first 6 months of 1977, retail sales in Miami topped $10 billion.
No sign of recession here.
South Florida has held up better than some of the other parts of the country.
In Miami, we were selling bulletproof cars for hundreds of thousands of dollars. You couldn't get a Ferrari or a Mercedes at all.
Some of the car dealers we checked with said they have less than a one-month supply of unsold cars. They said they are still taking deposits, though deliveries will be delayed.
They were all going to the drug dealer market.
Drugs and money, they go hand in hand in South Florida.
It's a $7 billion a year retail business. That's about $12,000 for each household in Dade County.
If you reach in your wallet in Miami and take out a bill and analyze that bill, you will find cocaine on it.
The profits for the drug lords have made the local economy recession resistant.
Every day, cash pours into our cocaine economy, buying real estate, boats, cars.
I had a turbo Porsche. I had a Mercedes back then. The 6.9 was the hot car.
We had an argument one time.
We got mad at each other, and she wanted something. I wouldn't give it to her.
I walked over and slapped him across the face.
She chased me around the driveway, and we took two Mercedes and just smashed him to death.
John pulled out a gun and shot at the car through the right next to my head.
I had to have somebody come pick him up on wreckers and destroy him.
We demolished both vehicles.
And then I'd laugh about it the next day.
We wrecked a lot of things.
Jesus, that was $100,000 worth of cars, you know? At that time, there was a company called LP Evans Mercedes. You had guys like Max, Raphael, two or three of Raphael's workers buying on an average, 8-10 Mercedes a year from the Mercedes dealer with a check from Panama. I mean, who buys 8-10 Mercedes a year? They didn't care back then. They would let me walk in. "Oh, how are you, Mr. Roberts? What do you need this week?" "I need the 6.9 over there." "Okay, is it all right in black?" "Yeah, he don't care what color it is." "I need a station wagon for his girlfriend." And I just write him a check. It wasn't even a cashier's check. I knew the guy in the Mercedes dealer. It was just a check drawn from a Panamanian bank. Out of the door would go the car.
Relatively little is being done to stop this disease-like spread of the cocaine economy.
Everybody wanted money back then.
It's not unusual for a Latin to spend $20,000 and more for all kinds of merchandise. And best of all for the merchant, he pays in cash.
If South Florida businessmen are not hooked on drugs, the experts say they can be addicted to drug money.
We'd purchased a Cessna Conquest we paid $980,000 for. In cash. How do you like that? We'll try that one today.
They never blinked an eye.
They suspect they know where the money comes from, but they're not going to bite the hand that feeds them.
Never blinked an eye.
Don't ask, don't tell. Take the money and run.
And they didn't give a shit.
Cocaine and marijuana sales through Miami generate so much money that smugglers literally have no place to put it all.
You don't understand, I had garbage bags in my lawn. You know, each bag had like $1,700,000 buried in the lawn because I had nowhere to put it.
He used to bury it in the horse feed too. I remember I'd be digging for horse feed. I'd find money in the horse bag.
And it was like, you know, nobody was questioning anything because my neighbor next to me, I was giving him 10 kilos a week.
Tierra del Rey, the neighborhood, was like falling apart when we moved in.
My neighbor across the street was getting 20 kilos a week, so he was watching out for me.
Everybody was hurting for money. All of a sudden, everybody had money. As a whole neighborhood. You shell out an extra 100 grand you're not supposed to, and it's okay. You know, John was good like that.
It didn't matter, though. It was never like, uh-oh, I don't have enough money to buy this. What, you know, how could that be? How could it possibly be? I had 3 cigarettes hanging in the backyard. 2 cougars. I had mountain lions living in my house. A helicopter in my backyard. And I used to fly with the helicopter to the racetrack. Everybody else was driving in cars. I'd land to see my horses run in the helicopter for like an hour and then go back home. I had 40, 50 horses at a time, race horses.
Oh, my God, he had terrific race horses.
Do you know what they cost a month to feed? $50,000 a month just to feed them.
You didn't care what it cost because you had money in your pocket. People went out and partied.
We suddenly had dozens of super high-end nightclubs opening.
It's been years since a real nightclub opened on Miami Beach.
The Jockey Club, Turnberry, the Palm Bay Club, the Cricket Club.
But the best of all clubs was definitely the Mutiny in Coconut Grove. It catered almost exclusively to the drug traffic.
If you were in that trade, you had the money. You could entertain people lavishly.
I mean, we used to go into restaurants.
To dinner at Arturo's or the Palm or Joe's Stone Crabs.
At that time, the Forge was the best restaurant. They would just give us the back room at the Forge and just close the whole back room down. And, you know, you could spend $20,000 in a night there. And we would destroy the walls, and here's the money, whatever we did, fix it up. It was like waste. It was like nothing, the money.
And John liked to go out to the ladies' bars.
It was nothing to spend $5,000 in a strip joint. I mean, you're talking about not one night. You're talking about 3-4 nights a week. And I tell my friend, you see that girl there? I guarantee I can get her to have sex with me tonight. And he would say, there's no way. She don't want to look at me and have sex. And I tell her, how much you need to have sex with this guy? She said, I'm not doing that. You're not doing it? Here's $500. I'm not doing it. Here's $1,000. You're not doing it? Here's $2,000. Eventually, like I said, she'd break down $2,000-$3,000. I'll have sex. And the guy would be like, you know, they'd be shaking. They couldn't understand how you do all this. I still believe it now, even though maybe Miami's changed. Everybody had a price. Everybody does have a price. There are very few people that don't.
You could start as high as Noriega in Panama, and you could go all the way down to city managers, to police departments. If somebody got pulled over and they had 50 kilos in the trunk, offer a bribe.
You know, maybe you couldn't bribe a cop with $20 or $50 or $100, but there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Tell them within an hour you'll have whatever it is that they want there in cash.
$500,000, $750,000.
But you got to leave with the coke. And most of the time it worked. I happen to know this lieutenant that worked in North Bay Village. Approached him one day and I said, listen, I want to unload some boats behind the North Bay Village Police Department. You think we got any problem doing that? Where he said, I'll tell you what, we'll have 2 patrol cars and we'll throw it in the back of the patrol cars and drive it wherever you want.
We had 4 mayors indicted, most of them convicted of engaging in corruption.
We became so powerful and had so much money.
Other places, were they more powerful than the government? Unfortunately, I think that that may be true.
I was a member of the Republican Inner Circle. Howard Baker sent me a letter and said, send me my contribution and we'll come to Washington. Here I am with all these senators and all these big people, and not one of them ever questioned me or even said to me, what is it you do down in Miami? Come on, they welcomed me in there because I made a big contribution to the Republican Party. You're in the inner circle. And I said to myself, you know, I did this, you know, all with drugs. And I did it with nothing else, you know.
Cocaine trafficking and the money, almost ruined any morality in this community.
Millions of dollars in cash supports a network of drug banks.
Have you ever seen a city with so many banks? You're going to tell me there's that kind of industry and business in this city? Please. Come on.
What makes law officials suspicious is that last year, South Florida banks took in $6 billion in extra cash from depositors.
Bank presidents were in rooms for days counting currency.
Is Landmark a cocaine bank?
It is not, definitely not.
Banks invested in huge cash counting machines.
Lacking storage space, the banks turned it over to the Federal Reserve.
Authorities say a bank this size normally deposits about $12 million a year in cash with the Federal Reserve. Last year, Continental National deposited $600 million in cash.
Are you saying that in this bank there is something wrong?
This is the counting room of the Federal Reserve Bank in Miami. Last year, the Federal Reserve Bank here generated a surplus in cash of $5 billion. More money than all of the other Federal Reserve banks in the country combined.
Miami could possibly be described as the overseas corporate headquarters for money laundering for the Colombians.
I started buying property all over the place.
There are thousands of properties worth more than $1 billion that have been bought with illicit money in South Florida.
A couple of houses.
We bought a boat company.
Property where the boat shop was at.
We bought apartments.
Lots of warehouse spaces.
We bought 480 acres of land up in Tampa.
Great deal of real estate.
We bought one other building so we could make it a radio room.
1,000 acres up here in Central Florida.
Drug dealers would come in and buy 8, 10, 15 houses.
One place in South Miami, I owned practically the whole neighborhood. I had $24 million in real estate.
I'm going to work one day. I come onto Interstate 95, which gives me a beautiful view of all of downtown Miami. Look at this, and we counted 22 construction cranes on the horizon that we could see. I said, I wonder how much of this is drug money.
God, how much did I spend?
And there was so much money that once it broke through, it couldn't be eradicated.
Probably as much as I put in the bank, $50 million, easily.
The billions of dollars may have funded a lot of development, a lot of construction in Miami, but it was blood money.
'79 was the year when things began to get really serious.
Certainly Dade Land really was more the defining moment. First public shot, the cocaine wars.
The shootout occurred at about 2:30 this afternoon when two or more Latin males entered the Crown Liquor Store here on the west end of the Dade Land Mall. They were followed by two or three other Latin males, and then the shooting began.
I mean, we knew exactly the minute we heard that. Another Colombian drug-related machine gunning.
Right now, two people are dead, and there are others injured.
Inside the liquor store, one Colombian national and another non-Cuban Latin suspected of drug trafficking lay face up in a pool of blood.
But I went racing down there, and I said, I'm from the Miami Herald, you know, what happened here? And the cops were just shocked and askance.
I have never seen in my life an extensive amount of, how would you put it?
Well, July 1979, I had been in homicide about 2 years. But this was just beyond the scope of anything anybody could have imagined it up until that date.
Well, there was this glass, there was debris all over the place. There were bullet casings on the wall, on the floor, on the shelf. It just looked like an old Western shootout.
The assailant sprayed gunfire all around the parking lot.
Did you see what happened to him when the shooting was over?
They ran.
Where?
I don't know. I was running.
Innocent bystanders dove for cover. Cars were riddled with machine gun fire, gas tanks spilling out.
Actually, there were two scenes. There were the primary scene where the two dead bodies were inside Crown Liquors. But the secondary scene, which is where I was assigned to, was what has become known as the War Wagon.
A delivery van was found abandoned in the north side of the mall with the door open and the motor running.
It was a 1979 brand new Ford Econoline van converted into an armed personnel carrier.
It was just a death machine.
It had reinforced steel welded to the sides. Windows could be popped out, used as gun ports.
You know, it said Happy Time Party Supply on the side.
Inside, we found 14 different weapons.
The killers were like the Dixie Cup generation, the throwaway generation. They would shoot a gun until it was empty, throw it down, and pick up another one.
And you name it. Shotguns, carbines, a MAC-10, an Uzi, assorted handguns, ammunition for all of them.
The war wagon was really, I think, the big turning point where the police realized what they were up against and how outgunned they were.
What would the amount of weaponry in that van indicate to you?
Well, they were well armed, we can say that, and they came prepared to do battle.
Bullets were flying everywhere.
The final tally were that 86 rounds had been fired by all the weapons.
God knows, I don't know how many times these people were shot. There's just so many bullet wounds over these victims that it just made it impossible for me to determine the exact number of shots.
We did the standard follow-up leads. The truck had been falsely registered. The firearms had been bought under false names. You went to the addresses, and the ones that were good, the people had fled. So it was your typical Columbia case. You know, went nowhere fast.
Officers searched the surrounding neighborhood for more than an hour, but turned up no suspects.
Like I said, another open pending. Open pending means an unsolved case, because we had no success whatsoever to date closing a Columbia murder. We had a brand new phenomenon here. The level of violence was unprecedented. The sophistication was unprecedented. I think this was the first case where we had actually a machine gunning in a public place, middle of daylight, shoppers and passersby around. Of course, after that, that happened frequently.
It was the beginning of a war. The cocaine wars down here.
Local homicide detectives say Miami's in the middle of a narcotics war between Colombian and Cuban drug dealers.
Miami was changing. The Colombians were pushing the Cubans out.
There was a mad scramble for market share.
And one of the reasons for the violence was because of the competing factions.
And the violence is what turned Miami into the cocaine cowboys.
As they called them, the cocaine cowboys.
They called them the cocaine cowboys.
This cocaine cowboy thing, it was all people from Medellin.
Estimates are that as many as 100,000 illegal Colombian aliens are living and working the drug trade in South Florida.
They would go after their target. They'd kill the wife. They'd kill the maid.
If there's a dog there, I'll kill the dog. If there's a bird there, I'll kill the bird. If there's a goldfish there, I'll kill the goldfish.
If a Girl Scout rang the bell to sell cookies, they'd kill the Girl Scout too.
Poor people that were standing there and kids, anybody would just get chopped up.
They just would kill everybody in sight.
Jesus Hernandez. A submachine barrage tore him apart in his car on a busy southwest street at noon.
Numerous machine gunnings.
And then I heard the ba-boom, ba-boom,
pop. And the apartment was sprayed by machine gun fire, a trademark, according to police, of the cocaine cowboys.
On the highways, the turnpike, US-1, in some cases residential streets.
The red Mustang was heading north on southwest 107th Avenue. The green sedan pulled alongside the driver, opening fire.
The tools of death, automatic weapons, and shotguns.
That's the kind of stuff you see on television. You don't see it in real life.
Witnesses describe the scene as a war zone, Miami Vice without the cameras.
But this was real life. It was really going on.
You have five people killed here. You have three people killed here.
A quiet residential area in Kendall tonight became the scene of a grisly mass murder. Six bodies were found in a posh townhouse.
Miami police say this is the worst multiple homicide in the city's history.
Police believe the massacre was drug-related.
We're talking about mass murders that in this day and age would get breaking news coverage from all the cable TV stations. We had that level of violence happening daily, and the local media, because of us just being saturated by it, saying, oh, it's just a double homicide. Oh, it's just a triple homicide.
It just became commonplace that we were going to be jumping from crime scene to crime scene.
We have to have more than four or five people dead to make a big deal out of it.
I mean, I can recall getting five murders in one night.
There have been 8 murders in Dade in just the past 48 hours.
You never knew when you were going to stumble over another body.
Miami kind of resembled the St. Valentine's Day Massacre in Chicago in the 20s.
Gangsters driving through the streets, standing on their floorboards with their Thompson 45 machine guns, having gunfights in Chicago in the 30s.
What I see going on here would make Chicago in the days of Prohibition look like a Baptist Sunday school picnic.
And one of the cops then even said, like, Dodge City.
It was like the Wild Wild West back here.
But of course he was wrong, because Dodge City was never as violent as Miami was then.
Miami in the early 80s was considered the most dangerous place on earth.
First Detroit was Murder City, then Atlanta, now Miami.
In 1976, we investigated 104 murders.
The first 7 months of 1979 have been called the bloodiest in South Florida's history.
There were 573 total homicides in 1980.
1981 will go down as another record year for killings around Greater Miami.
I think we're probably going to see in excess of 600 homicides by the end of the year.
As South Florida's drug trade prospers, Dade's homicide rate will continue to climb.
Crime in Miami is up and tourism is down.
Despite the gloom and doom that people are forecasting, we are predicting that we will have more foreign arrivals here in the Greater Miami area by the end of the summer than we did last year, which was our banner year.
For Fidel Castro, it was tantamount to an act of genocide. With one fell swoop, he rid Cuba of thousands and thousands of undesirables. He emptied his prisons. He cleared the bums off the streets of Havana. Murderers, thieves, perverts, prostitutes, the retarded, crippled, the winos, all were rounded up, sent to Mariel Harbor, and put aboard boats bound for Miami.
Fidel Castro himself publicly stated, "I have flushed the toilets of Cuba and the United States." He bragged about it.
One boat left Mariel for Key West every 5 minutes. They came unhindered, night and day.
It became commonplace in South Florida. Shots are fired, people are killed, and much of the time the killers are people who came over from Cuba in the boat lift of 1980.
Consequently, our homicide rate doubled that year.
It'd be like if an invading army was dropped in here to rape, pillage, and burn in our town. And that's exactly what they're doing.
Aggravated assaults, rapes, robberies.
In no time at all, we had bodies on the floor, we had them stacked up. It was a disgrace.
There have been so many murders throughout Greater Miami lately that a special refrigerated truck is now being used by the Dade Medical Examiner's Office to store all the bodies.
They had arranged to rent or borrow it from Burger King, whose headquarters is down here.
And I was very upset.
We have been invaded by aliens from outer space. These guys are spaced out.
Nobody seemed to be concerned about what was happening in the streets of Miami, so I opened my mouth.
They're psychologically totally not even human. They're animals. Not even animals. That's an insult to the animal kingdom.
There was no law and order whatsoever.
We all carrying guns. My wife carried guns. My two sons are carrying guns. You see that I have a shotgun loaded in my house, and we're going to shoot someone.
I certainly never traveled anywhere in Dade County without being armed. There's no question about that.
I always had a gun. I wouldn't sleep well without one, especially in the Miami of that time.
Edna Buchanan on national television saying she wears two guns and everybody has to wear a gun.
Merritt Stierheim, who was then the county manager, and all the commissioners were furious, so I was persona non grata for a while.
Miami was literally being torn apart at the seams.
But police help won't come soon because of a manpower shortage in the department.
Federal agencies readily admit they are crippled by lack of manpower, money, and resources.
The city of Miami Police Department went on a blind hiring frenzy.
It's hoped more police on the streets will help to reverse this record-setting trend.
And they used to have standards. You couldn't ever have used drugs if you wanted to be a policeman. So they reduced it to you couldn't have used drugs in the last 10 years, and that didn't work. So they said, well, you couldn't have used drugs in the last 5 years. They still couldn't recruit enough. So they said you couldn't have used drugs in the last 2 years, and finally it got to a point where if you're not under the influence of drugs at the moment, you're hired.
That resulted in the largest police corruption crisis since the Serpico days up in New York.
And the entire academy class from that year later on went to jail or died.
This makes a total of 3 Miami officers arrested over the weekend.
Today's arrest came as 7 other Miami officers went on trial accused of ripping off other cocaine dealers and for dealing drugs themselves.
The so-called cocaine cops have been charged with conspiracy, drug trafficking, and racketeering.
The tally, shocking. 40 current or former Miami police officers arrested or suspended in the last 2 years, 16 suspended in just the last 2 weeks, and it is not over. At least 30 more Miami cops will be suspended.
The rule of law completely broke down in South Florida.
We might as well just not even come to work and just give the streets up.
We truly are committed, and we are going to gain control of these streets once again.
The criminal justice system is not working now, and I suggest a revisit of the whole idea.
SANTAC 26 went fully operational in December of 81.
There were 25 previous SANTAC organizations in different cities in the United States.
SANTAC stands for Central Tactical Unit.
Our primary goal was to couple the homicide investigations with drug investigations.
They had good connections with the DEA, with the FBI.
We were dealing with a kind of criminal with whom we had not dealt before. And so my mandate to my people was very simple. Extraordinary times call for extraordinary measures.
And you would use whatever method you could to take someone out of the picture or off the street.
We're going to get rid of them either by putting them in jail or we're going to kill them.
It was a unit that was meant to be more proactive than reactive.
It was just a different way of doing police work, and it was called for at the time because of the nature of the criminal with both the Colombians and the Cuban criminals who came from Morrell.
Miami seems to have become paradise lost.
In the fall winter of 1981, the article Paradise Lost came out in Time magazine.
Time magazine crushed Miami.
The 9-page article inside focused primarily on Miami as the troubled center of drugs, crime, and refugees.
The politicians in Miami-Dade County and Miami went crazy when they saw that.
That's the number one question that's asked. Is it safe to come to Miami Beach?
And what do you tell them?
And again, I'm saying to them, unless you're coming down here to traffic in drugs, we are as safe here as you would be anywhere else in the world, including your own hometown.
We were torn between two worlds, fun and sun capital, murder capital.
That was the gist of that article, that the criminals were winning and we were losing.
I was born in Cali, Colombia, arriving in the United States in 1969.
Well, I grew up in Chicago.
I was a mechanic with my dad. I grew up for General Motors. That's where I learned how to break into cars.
Well, when I was growing up, I was known as a car thief, one of the biggest car thieves in Chicago, and then after the 80s, I was known to be an assassin for the cartel.
Stealing cars, sell them to chop shops. Between $200 and $500 a car. We used to steal five, six a night. It was three of us. So we're making good money. Better than working for my dad.
I come from a good family. I had everything I needed. You know, I didn't need to go steal cars, but it was just the money and the excitement of going and ripping somebody's car off and selling it, you know.
It's a Colombian restaurant. We used to hang out there because of the payphone. That's what the junkies used to call us. We used to, it's our office. I had a specific spot where I used to park my car, and no one would park there. The morning I got there, there was a car parked in front. So I asked the owner of the restaurant, whose car is that? He said it belongs to some big shots from Miami. So I told him I didn't give a fuck who they belong to. I wanted that car moved, so I took it. The next morning, we were in the restaurant, and three Colombians came in, and he asked who was Riverita. He said, I'm looking for a car. He stole my car. So I said, I'm the guy you're looking for. I'm leaving. He says, you stole my car, and I didn't want my car back. I said, you can't have it back unless you give me $500 for it, because it belongs to me now. Because you parked where you're not supposed to park. He started laughing. He said, you got some balls, you know that? I said, I heard that before. He said, so what are we going to do? I said, simple, $500. You get your car back. Pay me. Got his keys out and opened the trunk. It was full of guns, used guns, revolvers, automatic pistols.
and he asked me if I ever been to Florida. I said, yeah. With my dad. And if I had a driver's license, I said, yeah, I got my 6-year-old. He asked me if I could drive to Miami. I said, sure. I get paid. He said, yeah, he will pay me $5,000. I told him, yeah, no problem. When I got to Miami, I said, look, I got some things going. Maybe you guys could, you know, work for me and make some more money in Miami. If you could stay in Miami. I told him, what? He said, just deliver dope and pick up money. Maybe once in a while push somebody around. The money was good. He was paying me $1,000 a day. That was the first time that we were working with people that were in the drug business. But we didn't have no plans, so we started killing people. It turned out that was later, but a couple weeks went by. We were in a Jacaranda, Colombian nightclub in Miami. And Flaco came in. He was our drug carrier. He says, look, you need to get out of here because we're fixing to do a hit here. Those people on your right on the table, those six Colombians laughing and drinking fire water, Colombian I walked into. We're going to spray that table, the whole table. And I said, all right, appreciate it. I said, let me get my guys. And I told everyone except Vanegas Negro. He was in the bathroom snoring coke. Colombian Negro, because he was real dark. He was not black, he was just dark Colombian. So I went back to the bathroom and I told him, I said, we got to go. It's going to be a shootout here. But I didn't tell him who. He said, just give me a minute. I walked out. Well, during that time, Vanegas had stopped at the same table and told the guys to leave because there was going to be a shootout. So he screwed up the hit. It was just an accident. He knew one of the guys at the table, so that he was just looking out for his friend. I was outside. Vanegas came out. Behind Vanegas, everybody started pushing each other out. Blanco came in his motorcycle. He was pretty pissed off. He said, you guys fucked everything up. You know, I should have never told you nothing. I said, what you talking about? One of you guys tipped them off. Because they didn't know. And the only person that knew we were going to do the hit was you guys. You. I said, yeah, man, I just told my guys to leave. I said, hold up, let me talk to Negro. I said, did she tell them people? He said, I told one of the guys there was going to be a shooting like you told me, but I didn't know it was that table. I said, we in deep shit, you know. I went back home. I said, yeah, we did it, man. You know, it was an accident. He says, well, you're in trouble, man. Well, you're in trouble with my boss. The boss wants to meet you. Tell your boss there was an accident. He said, they don't want to hear it, man. Just you. He said, boss wants to meet just you. Either that or you're in trouble. So we get in the car. On the way, I'm telling him, I said, these people ain't going to kill me, are they? He says, I don't know. I don't make no guarantees, man. We have fucked something up. And I mean, they talk about killing six people. So you know there ain't no pussies here. He asked me if I had a gun. I said, yeah, man, I got a gun. But I had two over here. I had a backup gun on my left leg. So we drove to a Holiday Inn on I-95, and I looked, and four guys got out of the car. I said, is that them? He said, that's them. That's part of them. There's more to your left. And I looked, there was four other guys on the other side. I approached, the older guy was there. He said, are you Rivi? I said, yes, I am. Come with me. Got him back of a car, and in the backseat was a lady. She was calling the shots. Whatever she said, everybody would just keep quiet. Nobody gave an opinion. It was just whatever she was saying. And her husband was in the front seat. He didn't open his mouth. He's not asking me any questions, just her telling me what to do. She's the one with the power there. I'm getting this lip from a woman, you know. And I had, like, say, go fuck yourself or no. And she asked me, she said, you the one that fucked up the hit last night? And I said, in a way I did. And she told me, I've been after these people for months. And that's the first time that we got sight on them. And I have fucked it up. She says, well, I'll tell you what. You find them and you kill them for me. And we call it even. I'm interested in the two brothers. The other four we were just going to hit because they were sitting at the table. I said, you were going to kill four other people just to kill two? She said, that's the way I do my things. Spray the whole table. Get everybody out of the way. That surprised me, you know. I mean, she's talking to murder, like. So I told her, I said, just give me a week. I find these people. And she said, when you do, you call me. I give you $50,000 for each. So on my way back, I start asking Flaco questions. I said, what's up with this lady, man? He says, she's the godmother. I said, well, you know, fill me out a little bit about the godmother. He says, I know her since Colombia. And she's deadly. If you don't deliver, she's gonna put a hit on you. She was the biggest back then. She was the godmother of the cocaine trade. So when we got back to the hotel, I told the guys what happened, and Vanegas was there. So I said, look, we're in deep shit with this lady. If we don't find these people, we're gonna have to haul ass, because they're gonna come after. They told me in so many words. Vanegas, he said, yeah, I could get hold of one, the older one. I said, that's what we need, one. To him, we get the other one. I said, do this. Let's go to a payphone and beep him and set up a meeting for tonight. And we're gonna kidnap his ass and we're gonna turn it over to these other people. We beeped him, no answer. Second day we beeped, no answer. Third day, I was losing my hopes, no answer. Fourth day, he beeped the day I answered. He set up a meeting at the Ramada Inn. He told me that we had some guns and some explosives for sale. But the problem was, when he arrived at the hotel, he arrived with his kid. It was a 15-year-old boy, and we weren't counting no kid. So Vanegas, he made a smart move. He told to leave the kid in the car. Otherwise, we had to take the kid with us, too. He's talking, laughing with Vanegas. I'm behind a tree. And Vanegas opened the trunk. I came up behind the tree, and I put a gun in his ribs. I said, I've been looking for you. So the guy says, I owe you nothing. I said, no, you know, someone else needs you. This lady looking for you. Her name is Griselda Blanco. And he said, that fat bitch, I owe her nothing. So Kumbamba kicked him in the face, knocked his teeth out. He said, more respect for the lady. You tell her when you see her. We'll work for her. He turned white. He said, you're going to meet her in a couple of hours. He started shaking. So about an hour later, they arrived. They took him. The next day, I went home at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. She comes to my house. She just comes in like she owns the house. And my wife was frying fish. She said, oh, I love fish. She's eating, telling me how they killed this guy and chop him up in little pieces while we were having dinner. I said, what are you talking about? You shot this guy? She said, yeah, I shot him. And Kumbamba cut him up and put him in a small box and wrapped him up like a gift with a little bow on top. And we left a couple blocks from here on the turnpike. I said, in my neighborhood? She said, yeah. We're heading south to come and visit you. So we figured it was a good spot to drop him off. I just looked at her, I said, you're joking, right? She said, no, for real. I said, you see do this? She said, yeah, she likes it. She likes us to cut people up and just throw them like that. Griselda Blanco, she grew up with her mother in Medellin. Very poor. She was a prostitute. She started her criminal life as a pickpocket. Then they moved to New York. That's when they got into the drug business.
The first time I heard her name was the latter part of 1973. From the intelligence that we were given, she did figure as an emerging threat to the United States.
Her business grew.
She was a significant Colombian cocaine trafficker.
Ralph and Griselda, they were childhood friends.
So Ralph gave everything to her. In the mid-70s, Griselda got charged on a very large cocaine case in New York, probably the largest at the time, and she fled after that and took off.
There was a fugitive warrant issued for her. I lost track of her from the time of the indictment until I was transferred to Miami.
Well, we can't say for sure exactly when she was in Miami, probably 78. We didn't know where, obviously, because she was a fugitive. We knew she was a multi-kilo dealer.
In that very, very Latino culture, it's not usual that a woman would be the head of her own organization. So I figured that she had to have been one mean lady.
Griselda had to prove to all the other Colombians that she was worthy to keep the trade that they gave her.
And she'd like people to fear her. And they did.
People were so afraid of her. Her reputation preceded her wherever she went.
I made a mistake of not knowing exactly who she was at first. I met her at Rafa's at a party, and I love Latin women. So I went to Rafa, and I said, what's her story? And Rafa said, oh, no, you're not getting involved with her. And I said, why not? And he says, if you fuck this woman, I'm going to have to kill her. So I went to Max, and I said to Max, what's the woman's story? And Max started telling me these stories.
She was a hypochondriac.
She was pretty decadent.
She gave me a brand new Ferrari for Christmas. It was $80,000.
She collected wealth.
Her Christmas present was always like that, Spencer.
Ava Perón's ring.
And Jordy and stuff.
A bad freebase cocaine user and abuser.
A lesbian as well.
Paranoid.
Beyond the movies. I mean, I don't even think Miami Vice would be this flamboyant. Of course, she had the three older sons.
Thank you.
her last son, they named him Michael Corleone Sepulveda, which is fucking incredible.
As far as her murders go, my God.
They called her the Black Widow because she had killed a couple of her husbands or had them killed.
This woman literally slits men's throats after she sleeps with him.
I don't know how many times she did that.
Well, she's not going to do that because Rafa's going to tell her that, you know. And Max was like, don't make a difference. She could be bugged out one night and you sleep with her and she'll slit your throat. And what's going to happen here? It's going to be a war.
Griselda was worse than any of the men that were involved in this.
First homicide of note that she's involved with is Dayland.
That's when Griselda's crew walked into a liquor store and blew his head off. Well, half his head off.
Which, of course, is July 1979.
I guess he was dying for a drink.
And that's what established her as one of the most violent traffickers. No.
That's what really started right there, the cocaine wars.
As we started seeing more homicides, the role of Griselda Blanco became very, very prominent in what we were calling the cocaine wars.
She killed a lot of Colombians and a lot of Cubans to get her position in life.
Wherever they go, they take their special brand of viciousness with them. This woman, known as La Madrina, the godmother,
she was responsible for the majority of the homicides that occurred in South Florida during those days.
1979, 80, 81, 82. Those were the years where she did her killing in Dade County.
Griselda Blanco, she was really an angel of death.
I don't know that any other organization can be attributed to the number of homicides that go back to Griselda. I just don't.
And it could be over something as simple as she was in a restaurant the night before.
We went to the Perrots on the beach.
She could be eating at a table and the owner gave her a problem or something.
It was this big guy there, started running his mouth. He got small with me too.
And she decided, well, fuck this owner, I'm gonna destroy his business.
I saw it. We left.
And these guys would come on motorcycles and they'd turn around on the back of the motorcycles and just spray everybody waiting on line to get into the place and everything.
And then machine gun his ass down right in front of the door. Yeah, they were trying to pin on me, but I was out of town, so he must have messed with the wrong people.
Riverita became Griselda's main enforcer.
She was always with me and three, four guys.
She had an army with her.
A rogue cast of characters.
Her crew was almost like you would see in the movies.
She had Paco.
Paco Sepulveda, Diego Sepulveda.
Toto.
Carlos Benegas, Alonzo Ayala.
Just ragtag guys, you know, like the gang that couldn't shoot straight.
Hugo.
Guillermo Velasquez.
Only they actually could hit people.
Cumbamba.
Montego, Diego Escobar, Oscar Murillo.
Jaime Bravo.
They were mainly enforcers slash hitmen.
This is how they made their living. Some people are pharmacists and others are garbage men, and these are killers. And that's all that they did.
And Chucho Castro was her chief enforcer.
To me, he was one of the best enforcers that Griselda ever had. I mean, he's a legend. He always got his man. Osvaldo was Griselda's son. Back then, he was 15.
He wanted to live fast.
I mean, he was carrying guns and stuff. You know, he was dealing 300, 400 kilos of cocaine a month.
And this is all orchestrated by the mother. He wanted to look like Don Corleone, you know, and act like him. And he did.
Cocky attitude because of his mom. Real smart ass. He was in the Faces nightclub in Coconut Grove with his buddies and his girlfriend, you know. Chucho lived near there. So Osvaldo, he figured, well, I go camp over here at Chucho's house. He drove his car right to the front lawn, almost to the front door, skidding the tires on there, making a whole bunch of noise. So Chucho came out. So he told him, you know, to get the hell out of his house. So he said, well, if you don't let me spend the night, tell my mom. So Chucho said, I don't give a fuck who you tell. I don't give a fuck about your mom. Tell your mom that I said to fuck herself. Chucho kicked him in the ass. They told him, get back in your car, get the hell out of here. Tell your mom that I kicked your ass. So when the kid went back home, told his mom. And, you know, that's one thing about that. You couldn't touch your kids. It didn't matter who it was. That person would die.
There was always somebody that did something wrong. Whether they did or not, there was a reason for her to have a problem with them.
I was called that afternoon to her house. She said, I notified him that we have war, that he's no longer my friend, he's my enemy. So from this point on, if you see him, shoot him.
Rivi and his people were deployed in this area.
But it wasn't going to be easy because he's good. You make a mistake, we won't get him or we're going to get killed by this guy here.
Rivi, a driver, and a second gunman were in a white van.
I was going to be the shooter, so I grabbed an M16. And I just told the driver, when you get near him, you know, window to window, let me know. And I fired through the door. Because I knew if I opened the door when we were moving, he was going to know. He knew all the tricks.
Chucho opened up the garage door, drove out of his garage onto 168th Street, and then drove west towards US 1.
US 1, where the light was, it was about half a mile away. So we had plenty of time.
Somewhere in this area would have been where they would have, you know, caught up with Chucho, gone parallel with him, both westbound, and to the left, Chucho to the right.
And I grabbed the machine gun and I started shooting his tires, trying to blow his tires off. He lost control of the car that time. He almost hit a wall, but he took control and came back on the road this time.
And it's about that time they're approaching US 1.
By that time, we were real close to the red light. It was a gas station on the right-hand side.
As they approach US 1, Chucho then cuts through this gas station parking lot at a real high rate of speed, goes north on US 1, and that's when he loses the guy shooting at him.
Well, look everywhere. We didn't see him. So we just left. We said, you know, fucked it up. Well, the next day, Griselda called me. She says, his son got killed. His son was in the back of the car sleeping. And the bullets went right through the trunk of the car and hit him in the head. I said, we never saw him. Because if I would have seen it, we would have never touched that car. She says, he told me to tell you that he's going to get with you. Because he saw you. I said, that's fine.
Chucho was actually a fugitive, a federal fugitive. He was involved in trafficking. There was a warrant for his arrest from DEA. And that was the primary reason he was not going to get involved with reporting this thing to the police. He returned back home, put the baby in a bathtub, put ice around the baby so the baby would be preserved all evening. He and his wife spent the entire evening crying with his baby in the bathtub. The following day, he called the police to let us know where to find the body.
This is the phone calls that Jesus made to the complaint room. Please, I just left the body without life of a baby they killed yesterday. Excuse me, yesterday some bandidos that were in a white van shoot me with a machine gun. And the boy was sitting and they killed him. It's 7th Avenue and 53rd Street. The body of the boy they killed yesterday, the bandidos.
This is the mosque where the body of Johnny Castro was placed. Chucho was looking for the church where Johnny Castro had been confirmed months earlier, was unable to find the church. And this is the best he could do when he found this mosque, which was in the same neighborhood.
The child was wrapped in a sheet. In his hands was three roses, a rose for each year of the child's age. And I think passport, here it is. He knew, they needed the passport to show who he was. He was born March 10th, 1979. So he was almost 3 years old. Almost 3 years old. We realized that it's a Colombian child because of the passport and so forth. We made contact with Sergeant Singleton, Sentac, and his people. We knew it was Griselda Blanco, her group. We had gotten the name of Riverita, but nothing concrete, you know, no picture to say, okay, this is who you're looking for. Nothing like that.
I can't think of any other case where there was a child killed.
Little Johnny Castro shot just because he happened to be sitting next to his father, who was Colombian and a target of some of the cocaine cowboys.
I was a rookie homicide detective, only been up there less than a year. And my son was about the same age at that time.
People always ask me, you know, have bodies ever bothered you? And never, other than this one case.
I mean, that really hit me, you know, real hard. Because I had kids that age. It was an innocent baby, you know. Griselda, she says, well, fuck it, you know. At least we got him. I mean, she wasn't sorry about it. You know? She's like she didn't give a shit.
Even though the Colombians were wild in the way they did things, she would just do it even in a stupid way.
But it bothered a lot of people, not just here in the United States. It bothered people in Colombia.
Everybody would tell them this woman's out of control and she's going to ruin everybody's business.
He came back from those shores. Word to her that let's just get whoever's involved and let's try to avoid killing innocent people.
And the only thing that I remember the Colombians wanted of her was really to stay out of Miami as much as possible.
So she got a lot of hate from down there, but she says, you know what, fuck them all. I do what I want up here. If they don't like it, they could come after me too. Flat out, you know.
I would hear conversations in Spanish with Rafa because I was sitting in his house. That motherfucking girl again, she did this to me. Now what am I going to do? And I know he'd call down there and he'd ask the guys down there, what do you want me to do? And somehow this girl got a pass every time because she should have been dead a long time before her time, a long time.
Back to work.
Riverito, he became Griselda's most favored enforcer.
So like security, like I was like head of security. Nobody knew where she lived but me. Most of the meetings just took place in Rafa's house and Max's house. I met Max the first time at his home, matter of fact. I went there with Griselda. From that point on, I never liked him. I used to tell Griselda, I said, don't trust this motherfucker. I don't trust him. I said, listen, if you don't stay away from this guy, he's gonna put you in prison. Next time I run this guy, I'm gonna shoot him. He will run and tell Rafa, and they will come back to me and make sure nothing happens to Max, you know, take care of Max. He's my compadre. I said, fuck Max. I'm gonna shoot that motherfucker. He said, you gonna kill me? I said, not right now, but I will later.
I mean, you had to respect him because the guy came in with like tough talk, guns, and all these people with him. You're talking about a guy, anybody coming in anywhere with an entourage, you go, this guy is somebody.
I didn't go around flashing and stuff like that. You know, I had my house in Miami, in Palm Beach. I had a house in San Agustin, two houses in Chicago, my cars. I had plenty of cars. I'd buy them for my girlfriends too.
My wife, a couple of girlfriends. The life, you gotta keep a couple.
You know, it was what I wanted, what I like. I saw on the street, I bought it. You know, I didn't have to worry about the price.
I don't know, show business, kind of that type of thing.
A handsome guy, he spoke English, had a lot of charisma.
That's one of the reasons that she liked me so much, because I grew up in this country. I just didn't come across the water and and put me on the street.
Although he was as bad and probably killed more than any of the other ones.
I came from a good family, but I grew up on the streets in Chicago. I was a bad boy from the very beginning.
A stone cold killer.
To tell you the truth, I didn't like the guy very much because he used to brag to me about like people that he had killed and that sort of thing.
I told him I rolled my window down and I shot him with a Mac 11 on the face.
I don't want to hear, oh, we killed this guy here, there. It was like,
they're not killing anyone in the United States, only one in Europe. Anyway, they send me, I'll do it.
I don't want to hear about it, bragging about stuff.
As far as working in U.S. soil, I was the best.
It was unnerving in a way, you know, because he was an enforcer for this woman or whatever, you know, whatever he was.
He was the guy during years 82 to 84 that she used to basically exclusively to do her killings.
Reputation was that once I went after you, I will get you. If you run, I'm going to catch you.
If there was a drug debt to be collected, he was sent to collect it.
A lot of her customers, sometimes they were late. And she said, well, if you're not here tomorrow, I'll send Ruby after you. Oh, no, no, don't send him.
Alfredo Lorenzo was a drug customer of Griselda Blanco.
And Griselda ordered me to deliver 5 kilos of cocaine to them. And back then, it was a $50,000 each. It was $250,000.
Had been given cocaine on consignment.
That was the way Griselda did it. She says, how many days you need to pay me back? Oh, a week. Okay, I'm going to give you 2 weeks. When those 2 weeks were up, she didn't want the money. She wanted the person's life.
Rivi was sent to collect the debt.
I went to his house, you know, to pick up the money. Oh, you know, excuse. He says, tell her that to give me more credit and I'll come up with the money. I didn't say nothing to him. I just felt sorry for him.
Rivi realized that Lorenzo was giving him a line of bullshit, basically. And when he reported that back to Griselda,
she says, well, you know what to do.
Well, then his fate was sealed.
With Griselda, you didn't pay, you die.
Even the mafia would have some kind of code of honor.
The Italians would think and try to figure out, how am I going to get my money back? And maybe after I got my money, they would beat him to a pulp, but he was fine. 3 weeks later, he'd heal. As the Colombians came in, there was no beating people up. You know, the hot-blooded Latins, and they don't think first. They act first, and then they think afterwards. Even though they might kill the whole family, then they think to themselves, oh, my God, I screwed myself out of my money. How am I going to get my money when it's too late to actually get the money?
It's not about the money. It's just to prove a point. Don't rip me off. Don't fuck with me. Because I kill you, or I send somebody after you.
She said, you know, kill him. And then they did.
Miguel got on my right and Oscar Murillo, Nieto. He gets on the left and I knock on the door. Oscar opened the door. As soon as he opened the door, Miguel put a gun in his ribs. I signaled him to be quiet. I asked him what was his wife at. She said he's in the kitchen cooking. So I went and got her and she says, oh, I know what's going to go on. The only thing I'm asking for is don't hurt my kids.
Three children, two daughters, one son. The daughter's ages, I believe, are 6 and 4, and I think the son was like a baby.
I said, no, I'm not going to hurt your kids, you know. Griselda, when she gave me the orders to kill them, I figured I was just going to do him. When I was talking to her, I heard 2 shots, a couple. I knew what was done. Miguel had shot Alfredo. So I told Oscar, I said, watch her, I'll be right back. I went to the next room. I talked to Miguel. I said, done. He says, done. While we're talking, I heard the scream. And then I hear a machine gun go off. So I'm back to the room. That's what happened. He said, she tried to jump in. So Oscar fired, and she's been shot about 10, 15 times in the chest, but she was still alive. But she's making this weird noises, moaning, blood's coming out of her mouth, you know. She's dying. So I grabbed Miguel's gun. It was a 380 or something, and I shot it twice behind the head. Put her out of her misery. I thought, well, let's get out of here. But Miguel tells me, no, Cristiano told me to kill everybody in the house. That's what we're talking about. Some of the kids left. He says, no, I'm going to kill the kids. I said, no, you're not. He's telling me, she told me that she will pay me extra for them, so I'm going to make the money. I said, no, you're not going to kill no kids. Well, he's walking towards the kids where they're at. So I put my gun out, and I told him to leave the goddamn house. So Miguel got real mad. You got to get the little girls. I said, no, no. This is it. It's time to go. Get out of here. So I had to get them out of there at gunpoint.
Alfredo and Griselda Lorenzo were found shot and killed in June of 1982 in their home. It was a modest home in the road section of Miami.
Back in 1982, I had just recently gone to the Centax Quad. Received a call from Nelson Andrew, who was a homicide detective with the city of Miami. Bodies were in separate rooms of the house, and whoever committed the homicide left the children right inside the house with the dead parents. They actually found the 2 daughters and the son playing with the bloody dead body of their mother inside the house.
We got paid. So I explained to her what happened. I told her, I said, we didn't do the kids. She got pissed. She says the order was to kill everybody. I mean, when she said everybody, it means everybody. And I said, yeah, I made the decision to leave the kids alone. Why? I said, they're just babies. But after Johnny Costas, you know, when the baby got killed, I guess she got used to after that, you know, killing kids. She liked to be at war. Every day she was talking about it. We got to get so-and-so, we got to get so-and-so, we got to get rid of him. It was something that she enjoyed. She was a World War Pop woman here, and he used to be in the force for Griselda years back. Apparently he ripped her off, and he went on his own, and he declared war on Griselda.
Homicide investigators learned several weeks ago that a big shipment of cocaine worth several $1 million from Colombia never arrived here. Police say it was headed to New York City.
And that's one thing that she didn't forget or forgive. So I go to New York to kill everybody that was working for Papa Mejia, all his crew. Broke all their rules there too.
The words that the person that I spoke to was there was going to be a bloodbath.
From the stashers to the hitmen, 11 people. They all got killed. 11 people. In less than 24 hours. We were supposed to be 12, but I let one go.
Homicide detectives are now contacting New York police to investigate any similarities between any drug hits in the New York area and the recent drug assassinations here in South Florida.
They went to war. So Griselda took the first step.
We're now at the Mall of the Americas, which back in 1981 was called the Pan American Mall.
So we get to the mall, I set up all the cars where we want them at.
This is the scene of the Octavio Mejia homicide. He was Papo's father. Basically, when Mejia left the shopping mall, they ambushed him. And he was shot numerous times by several different gunmen.
A lot of people was pissed because they claimed that he wasn't part of the war between Papo and Griselda. So more people flip on Griselda. She created more enemies. When she didn't give a shit. She liked that. Well, I didn't know his son was there, Papo. He was in the car while his father went in the mall. I was pissed off because I missed him. I want to get him a different way. Somebody had tipped us off. He had a new house in Killian Parkway. So Griselda says, you're not going to miss this time, are you? I said, no, I'm going to blow the whole house up. She said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm going to put a bomb. Kill everybody. And I got about 200 sticks of dynamite. That goddamn explosion was so loud. First thing we looked was the roof come out of the house. The house came apart and the neighbor, all his windows were busted. The cars around the neighborhood, all the windows were busted. I just want to get to the good news that they found somebody in there. Turns out I missed again. The house was empty.
This is just one more, you know, skirmish in the Griselda Blanco, Mejia, you know, conflict.
2 weeks later, they had just gotten word that Papa Mejia was on the next flight to Miami, and he's by himself. Griselda, she says, well, we're going to get him at the airport. You are. She reached on one of the tables and stuff and hands me a bayonet, 16-inch bayonet. She said, I want you to get him with this. She wanted him stabbed to death. I said, what's this? Change styles or something, you know? They call him the pig. She wanted him killed like a pig. She offered me $500,000. She said, yeah, but you have to get him inside. I said, no, I don't go inside the airport. She said, why not? I said, no, it's a suicide mission. I don't do suicide missions.
Max Mermelstein and Riverita both strongly advised against this bizarre hit.
I'm not going into the airport and stab this guy to death because I'm going to go to jail. Got to get somebody else. She said, oh, I got somebody else. I said, who? This is Miguel Perez Miguelito.
Well, Miguelito is kind of like Rivi with no class.
I mean, Miguel told me one day if the money was right, he would walk up to the White House and kill the president.
This is a picture that was taken of him shortly after he arrived here in 1982 on the Mario boat lift.
He was one of the scariest guys I've ever really encountered in my career.
That's when they got the reputation, the Marilitos. Fearless Marilitos.
He was more physically intimidating. He was bigger than Rivi, stronger physically than Rivi. He's the kind of guy that you look at and you think to yourself, you know, this guy can snap any moment and go off and probably just snap your neck.
I talked to Miguel. He was all for it. He said, yeah, I'm going to do it. You know, they're going to give me $250,000 plus a house to get him inside the airport. I told Miguel, I said, if you go in there, I won't back you up.
But Miguelito just said, screw it, and he went and did it.
The only thing I'm going to do for you, I'm going to show you the Papa, point him out to you.
They knew what flight he was on, when he was arriving, and they were here waiting for him.
So sure enough, here comes Pop. Best thing he expected was a nigger to hit him.
And as he walked out from customs, a man came up with a bayonet.
Miguel's coming from behind him, puts him in choke and picks him up and starts stabbing him.
The bayonet, several times.
I counted 6 or 7. I mean, everybody in the airport was like, with their mouths open, like this. Because everybody's in shock, nobody's saying nothing. Drops on the floor, and he takes off running. That's when everybody started screaming.
Police, of course, ran to the area where this person was stabbed. They pointed out the direction that Miguel had fled in, and within moments, caught up with him.
Finally, the officer tackles Miguel. He lands about 3 feet away from me. And Miguel's looking at me like saying, help me, you know, with his eyes. And I just shook my hand. I said, that's nothing I could do. It was police officers coming from every direction. They took him into custody, and we just left.
This is really over the top because this place, even back then, pretty much crawls with police. There are police on every concourse. And to attempt something like that, it's insane, really. And obviously, it turned out that way because he was caught.
But that's the kind of person that Miguelito was. He didn't care. He had a job to do, and whatever it takes, you gave him a guy to kill, and that's what he did.
But Papo survived the stabbings. And Miguel, who was eventually convicted of attempted murder, sentenced to, I believe, 15 years.
That's the last time I saw Miguel.
That was the last overt act I know of as far as the Mejia-Griselda Blanco war.
Griselda Blanco was the catalyst for the recognition by the United States government that Miami had a serious problem, that we were really a Dodge City.
It was out of fucking control.
Believe it or not, when people start getting shot or getting killed, a lot of heat comes from it.
You had this goose that kept laying golden eggs. Why mess it up?
That was all because of the violence. It wasn't because, you know, there were so many drugs coming. They didn't have a clue as to how many drugs were coming. They started forming special groups.
A special anti-narcotics detective squad known as Centec 26.
I mean, I had guys chasing me. I never, you know, who the hell, what do you, you know, I don't even know who these people were. You know, I mean, where'd they come from?
Prosecutors expect more arrests of drug dealers in the near future.
Reagan had been elected.
We need to get the president to come to Dade County to talk to the widow of a taxi cab driver whose head's been blown away.
The cocaine wars, the level of violence, the homicide rate, the cover of time, Paradise Lost, led to action. Vice President Bush's task force on violent crime in South Florida flooding Miami with federal agents.
It is a joint operation with the state people, local police officials, Coast Guard, Customs.
South Florida cannot be a haven for criminals, for sophisticated and organized drug traffickers, for hired assassins.
Finally, the rest of the United States was waking up to it, that it was not a Miami problem, it was a national problem.
This initiative will bring together all our resources to combat the major drug traffic and the crime problems of Miami.
After they sent a telegram to the president imploring him to put Homestead Air Force Base on a war footing to intercept, stop, and shoot down if necessary drug-laden clandestine aircraft and vessels which are trying to smuggle narcotics into Florida.
We have an unidentified vessel just west of West End, Grand Bahama. Can you send an aircraft out to visually ID him?
I have received authorization from the government of Colombia to fire into your vessel.
Range 160, all right?
Please, please, stop, stop.
Tell him to stop and I will stop.
Get hit. Got smoke.
And agents say their dockside test confirms they got a ton of cocaine worth $31 million wholesale, a cool billion on the street.
The amount of drugs that was seized in this area has gone up 2,500%.
The net weight appears to be somewhere around 3,700 pounds. It's by far the largest seizure ever made by the federal government. In fact, I would say it's four times the largest we've ever made.
Are you saying that it will no longer be possible to smuggle drugs into the United States?
No, I never say that.
What are you saying? What claims do you make for the
case? It's becoming progressively more difficult.
The good news is that Miami's runaway crime rate has been brought under control, that there is now a full-scale commitment on the part of citizens, government, police, and our courts to wage a battle against the criminal enemy.
And it really was the beginning of the end of the cocaine cowboys era.
The murder rate has certainly come down since 1980. There's been like a 50% decrease in the inner city and about a 30% decrease in the suburbs.
So it was just too much police and a lot of heat on TV. So I talked to Shelly. I said, you know, it's getting real hot here. Let's take a vacation somewhere. She said, yeah, you know, we're thinking about moving the operations to California. Gravy, are you going with me? I'm done with the killing. I got enough money. I'm going back to Chicago.
Now that we know, you know, in hindsight, that she left the area back in around 1984, clearly the homicide rate went down in that time period.
I was happy to leave Miami because I knew all this heat that was around me, you know, and she didn't want to understand this.
Faced with the fact that the whole organization had relocated to California and I'm a Miami agent, I had to convince my superiors that it was worthwhile for me to investigate a case in California.
I knew it was just a matter of time before they came after us.
You know, I said, if I ever get her, I'm going to give her a kiss on the cheek.
So she went to California and started her business out there. Rafa didn't want to really send product out there, so she decided to become friendly with Marta to get the cocaine.
She was a relative of the Ochoas.
Well, I don't need Rafa. I can get everything I want this way. And she did. And Max says to me, there isn't going to be any coke for a while because there's a big problem here. Griselda decided she doesn't want to pay for like 1,500 kilos or something. And I said, well, what does that have to do with us? Well, the Ochoas don't want to send anything until everything is straightened out.
So Griselda says, I want to kill this bitch. I said, who would that be? She said, this bitch.
Griselda's answer was, if she killed Martha, there would never be any proof whether she gave the money to Martha, and Martha didn't send the money to her family.
I started telling Griselda, I said, if this is done, your business goes down the drain. Ain't no place for us to hide. Nowhere in the world. They're going to chase you for the rest of your life. No, it needs to be done. I said, this nonsense needs to be done.
That was her out. I'm just going to kill Martha, and then I'm going to say I gave her the money. And this way they can come to me. Hey, I don't know where the money is. I gave it to her.
I told Griselda, I said, what are you going to do? She said, just kill her. As soon as she walked in, she saw Griselda, she shit on herself. She said, Madrina, godmother, you know, what have I done to you? Griselda says nothing.
She was kidnapped and then murdered and found on the side of the road.
Obviously, she was blood, Martha, and you couldn't kill Martha.
That's when another war started.
And this is what all blew up in her face.
Everybody turned on her. Rafa, which was her best friend, flipped on her.
And I remember Rafa and everybody...
Everybody from the cartel.
...deciding, well, I think we're going to have to kill this woman.
There was a price on Griselda's head.
They told her, whenever we see you, we are going after you.
Max getting in trouble. That was the beginning of the end.
He knew he had a problem. He should have smoked it, but he didn't. He didn't think it was coming to him.
Max calls me up. He said, I think I got some heat. I'm getting in my car, and I'm going for a ride. You stay on the cell phone with me. Okay, Max, I'll stay on the phone with you.
So Max gets in his car and drives out.
He gets out of his driveway. He says, uh-oh, they're coming from every direction.
I knew I was under surveillance. The marked cars blocked off my path. And the next thing I know, I had 40 guns pointing at me.
End of the conversation.
And they arrested him. That was the last we saw of Max.
I got like millions of dollars buried in garbage bags in my lawn. That night, I'm out there with a flashlight digging up bags of money because I'm afraid they're coming. And I lived on the Everglades. I jumped in a canoe I had with like, I'm not exactly, $6 to $8 million, threw it in the canoe, paddled to the other side and buried it in the Everglades, thinking they're coming to my house. Nobody came, nothing happened.
Nobody thought there was going to be any problem.
Mickey and everybody said, well, I haven't seen any problems when the last plane that landed, you know, everything seemed to be fine. I said, okay, well, then let's just keep going until we find out.
John said there was no reason to be worried. We thought John was so smart.
I remember September 20th for the simple reason that I couldn't sleep. At that particular night, I was working with Mickey and his crew. And because I couldn't sleep, I decided that I would go to a radio room that we had set up here in Miami to monitor the incoming planes.
It was a regular trip. The only thing that was unusual, and it should have given away, was real quiet on the radio. Of course, they know that we listened to everything.
Tell you the truth, I looked around when I drove up because I was still paranoid from Max, and I saw nothing. Nothing at all.
Everything went as usual.
The plane landed. I said, oh, man, another good trip. I'm going home. I feel great.
And as soon as the airplane landed, went in the barn, and they showed up in helicopters, and all kinds of people jumped out with guns everywhere.
Step down slowly. Keep your hands in the air. Hands right in the
air. I heard a noise. It was like the place was hit with lightning or thunder.
And the guys that were in the airplane, they all ran.
And they just drove this truck probably 60 miles an hour through the front door.
It was a simultaneous bus, Tampa with Miami.
They came in there all in black and with these night goggles and masks. And it was like, I said, what am I, back in Vietnam here? Well, you know, this is nuts.
I went out the back door.
Like, what am I going to shoot it out with you guys?
Small confrontation with one of the guys.
Get on the floor and shut up. Yeah, all right. And they looked at me at first, and I'll never forget, Roberts, what are you doing here? I said, I guess I fucked up, huh? He said, you fucked up, man. We would have come to your house later, but what are you doing? You made it easy for us. I said, I couldn't sleep, man. He said, well, it's too bad. And when I got downtown, I heard on the radio, they're shooting, there's gunfire, bang, there's all kinds of war. I said, what's going on here? You know, what is this involving me? That's your plane. That's your farm up there. There's gunfire. They're shooting.
They were running all over. They were shooting guns.
Your friend shooting at us. My friend, Mickey.
I tried to burn the airplane.
The Mickey had a flare gun, and around the plane there were gasoline tanks which were used to refuel the plane to get out of there.
I pushed one over.
Well, Mickey wanted to escape, so he shot the flare gun.
So I hit the swamp. I watched the show all day long.
And they couldn't find him, and they were chasing him through the woods all night.
These people went nuts.
Early this morning, Customs and FBI agents began a roundup of 12 people authorities say helped transport nearly 20,000 pounds of cocaine into this country by sea and by air from Colombia. One of the men behind the scheme was fugitive Michael Mundy.
The Mundy organization transported cocaine from Colombia using aircraft making direct flights, an aircraft in combination with small boats where the aircraft dropped the loads in the Bahamas.
It wasn't their cocaine, and they didn't sell cocaine on the streets. All they did was transport for other people and charge a fee for that transportation. Basically a contract service.
Many of those shipments were attached to a highly sophisticated homing beacon that allowed the bad guys to find their drugs when authorities were not around.
This transmits a radio signal as well as having infrared light so they can see it at night with infrared goggles. So this shows how sophisticated they were.
Max Mermelstein becomes a witness, wants to talk about, among other things, murders in Miami. We're going to debrief this guy.
And quite frankly, at first, I didn't believe 75% of what he said. It was just too outlandish.
Max rolled.
He rolled over on all of us.
And started cooperating with them in jail.
I told John, he didn't listen to me.
I told him from day one that Max was weak, that he was snitching us later, you know, down the road. And, you know, that's why I wanted to kill him so bad. They wouldn't let me, you know.
The government had no idea, and honest to God, if it wasn't for Max Mermelstein,
I don't think they would have ever caught us.
He filled in the gaps.
They knew nothing of where the farm was. They knew nothing of our trips. They knew nothing. We had been working for like 5 years.
Max was like family. I never figured he'd do what he did.
They came the next day and they busted our gate and seized the house.
We were able to seize property in the value of $130 million in the Florida area.
35 Paso Fino breeding horses and 35 acres of ranch land in Marion County, Florida was also confiscated.
It's front page newspaper the next day, and everybody was all over me. I mean, people wanting to kill me because they said John owed him money. People that had his money certainly weren't giving it to me.
And Max made the indictment against Mickey and me.
When I'm reading the indictment, I'm also just like, holy shit. I didn't realize that he was actually working with the cartel. I didn't know Rafa was in the car. I didn't know any of this. I mean, I'm not saying I didn't know anything. I'm just saying nobody realized the magnitude of what John was involved in.
You get on a trip where you're making so much money that you were just so powerful that nothing was gonna, it wasn't gonna happen.
And I remember the day he was, you know, sitting in the chair crying like a baby, that he had to leave everything he loved. And
I have nobody to blame but myself. Nobody.
Time to go. You got to go.
Every day I talked to her, she said, no, you know, you were wrong. He's not a rat. He's not. I said, he's working for the police. That's why I'm not near you. Because you're going to go to jail, but I ain't going with you. Oh, come to Los Angeles. I said, no. I'm all right over here.
We located a small house that they had rented. We knew that she was in the residence, so we found her. And in we went. I went upstairs and found her sitting in bed reading the Bible. And I just walked up to her. Obviously, I had my weapon drawn. She was pretty startled. You would never think that she was a violent, homicidal maniac.
They arrested her at home.
And then I gave her a little kiss on the cheek, as I promised I would to the agents many, many months earlier.
Police are saying she may be responsible for as many as 200 murders. That over a period of more than a decade of drug wars. Tonight, an arrest that could bring down one of South Florida's most infamous crime figures.
Days later, they arrested her kids. Everything crumbled for real, you know. I'm just looking now for myself. Everybody's in prison except me, and they're looking for me now.
About the same time, he and his brothers are out to the airport in a stolen vehicle. They get stopped by the sheriff's office, resist arrest, they've got cocaine on them. So they are in custody.
Ever since then, I've been in custody.
Eventually, the drug market was seriously dismembered by law enforcement, and a lot of that money kind of disappeared. And as drug merchants were being prosecuted, convicted, and imprisoned, a remarkable thing happened. The businesses that they frequented and supported started drying up and closing down.
The Sunshine State Bank is out of business. Sunshine State allegedly was bought with laundered drug money.
All of the nightclubs dried up. Car dealerships started to go broke. Jewelry shops.
The real estate values are deteriorating tremendously. The businesses as such have been suffering tremendously.
And that collapse created new opportunity. The economy of Miami was kept together by speculators who had made a lot of money in the drug trades. If you were a car dealer whose sales went from $20 million a year to $60 million a year for 10 years, you've got an extra $500 million kicking around.
It might not have been there if you didn't have the horrors of the cocaine cowboys, absolutely.
Drugs destroy a community when you're dealing with street level. When you're talking about drug dealing on a level where major drug dealers are living here, vacationing here, buying homes, laundering their money and so forth, that picks up the economy of a city or of a community.
And a lot of the money secretly did go into infrastructure.
$2.3 billion worth of construction is currently underway in downtown Miami.
The general construction and everything in downtown and on Brickell.
Downtown Development Authority officials say another $1 billion worth of construction will be in progress within the next 6 to 8 months.
It built half the city. It built the high-rises. It built the scrapes.
This building boom, they say, will last for the next 10 years.
The drug trade saved Miami in a lot of ways. If you look out at this skyline, a lot of this real estate was built or bought and paid for with drug money.
This new construction means at least 25,000 additional jobs and an annual payroll in the millions. The new condominiums, office buildings, and banks will add an additional $20 million to the city of Miami's tax base.
As you had the cocaine coming into Miami, and as you had the millions of dollars going into Latin America, legitimate Miami also realized we're the gateway to the Americas.
The drug trade certainly put Miami on the map.
Newsweek has called Miami America's Casablanca. What a contrast from 7 years ago.
One thing about the horrible publicity, there was a lot of it. Miami was on everyone's lips.
Miami.
To Miami Beach.
Everywhere in the world.
People said, you know, I've always wanted to go to Miami. Is it really like this? The beaches I see and the beautiful women and the nightclubs.
It's called Club 1235. It's the place where that big Miami Vice Bash was held Saturday night.
We were on TV every Friday night, prime time, with Miami Vice. The storylines were based entirely on drug trafficking.
Miami Vice may not enhance the city's image, but it's doing great things for the local economy.
Don Johnson and Miami Vice and Al Pacino and Scarface.
It was alluring.
This is Miami. Things are more relaxed.
It was interesting because when Miami Vice came out, they would find an old dilapidated or abandoned hotel or gas station on Miami Beach. They'd put in neon, they'd paint it, they'd fix it up, they'd rehab it and shoot their scenes there and leave a rehabilitated site behind. And I think they made a lot of people see what the possibilities were.
In the late 80s and early 90s, the European modeling industry discovered South Beach. And of course, after the models come the wealthy European visitors who are chasing the models.
And we ended up getting the Glitterati.
It reminds me of Greenwich Village, 1965, because it's happening
And it's new?
Then the paparazzi took it from there and created a phenomenon.
Took it from a predominantly sleepy vacation spot to a thriving international capital of the Americas.
And the world again started to flock to Miami. We made it.
I think we could have had a renaissance without so many people having to die for it. I could have lived without it, and so could a lot of other people have lived without the enormous contribution of money to this community. There was too much collateral damage.
I don't think the economic benefits were worth the costs on society.
I still love Miami, but I think I love it more for what it was before the cocaine wars. I mean, at what price a skyline? How many people have to die for a shiny skyline? It wasn't worth it. Too many people died for it.
But Miami, honestly, couldn't be where it is now without having to go through the horrors and tragedies of the 70s and 80s.
Today, people kind of get a kick out of talking about how they survived the 70s and 80s in Miami.
I came back here because I had to come back here. I had no choice. And when I first got out, I'll never forget, I went to the hotel on South Beach. It's called the Surf Comer. And the first morning I woke up, I remember going to the beach. I was laying there, and here comes this girl out of the water. And as she's walking out of the water, I see she's got no top on. And you got to realize, I'm in jail now, 11 years or something, and I'm looking at this girl with no top on. I'm saying, my God, I got scared. I ran back to the room, and I wouldn't even come out of the room for like a day. I was so like, what happened? The whole world has changed here, you know?
The city had grown so much in the 12 years that I was gone.
I don't know, you know, times change. Back then, we just didn't give a shit.
Miami back then was an open town. It was completely different.
I mean, if you told me you want to kill so-and-so, all I asked you was just point him out to me, and I went and shot him.
Now it's not open anymore, you know, it's a different town.
These days, I wouldn't do it. I'll do it differently, totally different.
It's a much different city than I remember it. And a lot of people I know, you know, they're not around anymore.
My friend that we grew up together, they're all dead. They got killed. Guilty to the three murders.
A life sentence on each case to be served concurrently.
I've been here ever since.
As a result of the information given to us by Rivi, there were 14 different homicides closed on Griselda Blanco's organization. When he flipped and told us chapter and verse about all these different homicides and how she ordered them, then she was done. She was essentially our John Gotti, and Rivi was our Sammy the Bull Gravano.
The case against Griselda Blanco turned out to be like a total dud.
Incredibly disappointing and frustrating.
She ended up pleading to like basically a walk in the park.
Through the cracks.
Yeah. I thought we had her.
I mean, it was shameful. What happened?
So once we lost Remy, we lost the connection between the hit guys and Griselda.
Rivarita created the case and destroyed the case.
Basically torpedoed one of the most significant homicide investigations that I could even imagine being done.
During the course of her reign of terror, if you will, she made a lot of enemies, both here and in Colombia.
And they haven't forgotten, and they certainly haven't forgotten with respect to Uber and Osvaldo.
The saying that live by the sword and die by the sword is very true in the business they were in.
And it's likely that if she's ever returned to Colombia, that she'll meet the same fate.
There's certainly nobody more deserving of the death penalty than she is. She should be on death row. But take a little bit of comfort in the fact that at least until I retire, she'll still be in prison. I can't say for how much longer, but she will still be in prison as long as I'm a cop.
In Orlando, in Disney World with my kids, and I was talking to these people from Germany. Oh, you're from Miami. Oh, my God. What's wrong with Miami? Oh, my God, they kill their people every day. I'm watching the news in Europe, and I said, yes, man, they do. It's very dangerous stuff. Oh, I'm not going there on vacation. My wife was just looking at me like, if he only knew.
But the thing I wanted to know was what happened to all the money.
The invasion came before dawn when U.S. fighter jets bombed General Noriega's military headquarters.
Utilize the position to sell the country of Panama to the traffickers.
When Noriega went down through that bank in Panama, we lost about $140 million between Max, myself, Rafa, Ochoa's, Escobar. Everybody took a big chunk.
That's how come we lost so much.
Because I was in jail at the time. And there was no way to get your money out. And the government seized all the money in that bank. They took all the money.
We went to a movie theater and got in line for about 2 hours to go and see Scarface, the famous movie Scarface. Myself and nine other guys, all 10 killers. Movie started, you know, with all these attempts on him. They claimed they brought two cars to kill him. We were just laughing. We would have had him. If it were taking place in real life, we would have got him.